Welcome to Twisted Travel and True Crime. I'm your host, Sandy. I want to warn you that this episode contains themes of sexual violence, child sexual abuse, and incest. It may not be appropriate for all audiences or for you if these things are a trigger. For a while, the residents of Manitoba Colony thought demons were raping the town's women. There was no other explanation. No way of explaining how a woman could wake up with blood and stains smeared across her sheets and no memory of the previous night. No way of explaining how other women in different houses went to sleep clothed, only to wake up naked and covered by dirty fingerprints all over her body. No way to understand how yet another could dream of a man forcing himself onto her in a field and then wake up the next morning with grass in her hair. The women and children of the community thought they were going crazy. This week, our twisted travels take us to Manitoba, not Canada, but a colony in Bolivia. One important note about the victims in this episode is that I changed their names in order to protect their privacy. Please keep that in mind if you research this story for yourself. The Manitoba colony consists of roughly 2,000 people. It's very small and very Mennonite. Although there are several Mennonite communities near where I live, my knowledge of them is minimal. Let's just say I've learned a lot researching for this episode. One thing is certain, very few if any Mennonites will hear this episode as they don't tend to own electronic devices. Most choose to live their lives very simply. It's been said that the most strict Mennonites choose to live like people did in the 15th century, and this was the way the people of the Manitoba colony lived. They're known for their commitment to nonviolence and simplicity, choosing to live in close-knit agricultural communities. However, it's important to note that there is considerable diversity between Mennonites, with variations in beliefs and practices based on geographical location, cultural background, and religious interpretation. In the mid-2000s, Sarah Gunter's life became entangled in a bizarre mystery, with bits of rope as its centerpiece. She would wake up feeling groggy, her limbs heavy, and her mind cloudy. When she tried to move, she had trouble willing her arms and legs to work. When they fought against her will, she studied them and found remnants of fibers on her wrists and ankles. Her skin was red and abraded. Once, she woke up with rope still binding her wrists, her hands tingling beneath a haunting shade of blue. This was Sarah's reality. A chilling experience that took place within the rustic confines of her own home, a place that should have been safe and serene. Nestled amidst fields planted with the aroma of soy and sorghum, Sarah's humble home, built out of simple concrete but painted to look like brick, stood like a fortress against the encroaching tide of modern life. Here, in the heart of an ultra-conservative Mennonite community, the rejection of modern technology and the outside world was preached by parents and trumpeted from the pulpit at Sunday services. Sarah wasn't the only one in the home to be affected by these bizarre experiences. Her 17 and 18-year-old daughters experienced mornings where they woke, laying on stained sheets with semen and dirt on their beds and bodies. Their throbbing headaches and a suffocating lethargy, all pointing to unspeakable violations. But violations they kept to themselves. They felt as if they were being punished by God, or worse. Locking doors and trying to stay awake all night were feeble defenses against whatever the evil forces were that plagued their one-story home. The house was shrouded in darkness, as were most of the homes in the Manitoba colony, as they weren't wired for electricity, and like many others, it was isolated. Imagine farm after farm dotting the landscape. In the beginning, the family had no idea that they weren't the only ones being attacked, and they kept it to themselves. Then Sarah started telling her sisters. When rumors spread, no one believed her, said Peter Fair, Sarah's neighbor at the time of the incidents. We thought she was making it up to hide an affair. The family's pleas for help to the Council of Church Ministers, the group of men who governed the colony, were fruitless. Even as the tales multiplied. Across Manitoba, a shadow of fear darkened each morning as torn pajamas, crimson stains, and a haze of disorientation revealed the scope of the terror. Some dismissed it as female hysteria, while others whispered of divine retribution. We only knew that something strange was happening in the night, Abraham Wall Ends, the colony's erstwhile leader, confessed. But we didn't know who was doing it, so how could we stop it? No one knew what to do, and so no one did anything at all. After a while, Sarah just accepted those nights as a horrible fact of life. On the following mornings, her family would rise despite the head pain, strip the beds, and get on with their days. These occurrences went on for 5 years. 5 years of people turning a blind eye to what was going on in their community. Why? Well, I'll try to explain. But in order to do so, we have to understand the community. Today, there are over 350,000 old colonists scattered across the globe, with over 60,000 of them living in Bolivia. Old colonists is the name given to Mennonites who believe that the only way they will get into heaven is if they live in the ways of their forefathers. They're appalled by other Mennonites who are so easily seduced by the New World. They warn their children that outsiders are looking to steal them away from their families, which is just one way they isolate them. They don't allow children to listen to music, have electronics like phones or tablets, and there are very few, if any, toys. If they're lucky, they're allowed to kick a ball around. That's because hard work is everything to these families. At a very young age, children are taught to work the gardens and tend to animals. As they get older, they're given jobs based on their gender. Girls are to garden, cook, clean, and tend to children. Housework is outside the domain of the boys. It's possible they'll go through their entire lives without ever clearing their own plates. They work the fields, and during the farming off-season, the older ones assemble tractor equipment their fathers import from China, while the younger boys play by climbing the barn posts and playing with family pets and livestock. The boys might kick around a soccer ball or practice Spanish by reading the occasional newspaper delivered weekly from Santa Cruz. However, any other organized activity, be it competitive sport, dance, or music, could jeopardize their eternal salvation and is strictly forbidden. Children are raised speaking Old German, but the women are never taught the local language, so they can't communicate with people outside the colony. In fact, most of the girls have no formal education beyond the age of 12. Women are not afraid of giving birth naturally and frequently. Some will go on to have 15 or more children. Children are a blessing and become great workers on the farms. The Manitoba colony, established in 1991, presents itself as a sanctuary of order amidst the surrounding chaos of South America's poverty-stricken and indigenous communities. Anchored by the unwavering work ethic of its members, fertile fields, and a communal milk factory, the colony thrives economically. Manitoba has become the quintessential haven for devout old colony Mennonites, who have a history of migration. They move when the world and its evils encroach on their territories. While other colonies in Bolivia have relaxed their traditions, Manitobans vehemently adhere to strict codes. They shun automobiles, favoring tractors with steel tires to avoid the temptation of worldly interaction facilitated by rubber-tired vehicles. Men are prohibited from growing facial hair and are required to wear denim overalls, except during church services, where they opt for slacks. Women and girls meticulously style their hair in identical braids, a traditional style, as well as the traditional dress designs they wear. For the residents of Manitoba, these rules are not arbitrary. They are believed to be the only route to salvation, and sticking to them is believed to determine the fate of their souls. In matters of law enforcement, Manitoba operates independently. Save for cases of murder, community leaders are not mandated by the Bolivian government to report crimes. Police jurisdiction within the colony is virtually non-existent, and state or municipal authorities hold no sway. Governance is maintained by a de facto administration, consisting of 9 ministers and a ruling bishop, all appointed for life. Apart from the government's requirements for residents to possess state identity cards, Manitoba operates as a quasi-sovereign state, independent of external interference. What this means is that no one was doing any type of investigation into what was going on inside the homes of the families in Manitoba Colony. In the home of one family, a middle-aged mother of 11 and her husband recounted an incident from 2008. She heard a hissing sound as she got into bed. This was followed by a strange smell. She nudged her husband, asking whether he had shut off the kitchen gas canister or whether it might be leaking. He reassured her that everything was fine, and the couple drifted off to sleep. In the dark of night, she vividly remembered waking up to find a man on top of her and others in the room, but she couldn't lift her arms in defense. She soon slipped back into an unconscious state, waking the next morning with a pounding headache and soiled sheets. The assaults persisted over the ensuing years, causing her to endure various medical complications, including a procedure related to her uterus. In conservative Mennonite communities like hers, discussing matters of sex and reproductive health remain taboo. What they learn is what comes from tradition, whatever their parents choose to teach them, and the Bible. But since many passages in the Bible are up for interpretation, it's up to the reader and the teacher to determine what's being said. This lack of knowledge, her embarrassment, and fear she was being punished for her sins, hindered her willingness to share certain details about the attacks and their aftermath. Remembering one morning when she woke up in excruciating pain, she said, "I thought I was going to die." After 5 years, answers finally came. In June 2009, a young man was caught inside someone's house. Interrogations by friends and neighbors led to the apprehension of 8 other individuals, all Mennonites. 9 in total, 8 from Manitoba and 1 from a neighboring colony. They were held for a time by the community before the men were handed over to Bolivian authorities. The men had confessed and provided details of the assaults. One man I will call Abraham said, "They admitted to breaking into my house and doing whatever they pleased. There were 4 of them." Once the news broke, daughters finally opened up to their parents, confirming the men's accounts. My daughters recalled something happening, although they weren't sure what. They described the pain they experienced in their vaginal area and legs, said Abraham. Court documents would later amplify these testimonies, with women and girls recounting being raped by multiple men, discovering unfamiliar bloody rags, and attempting to scream, but finding themselves unable to do so. How could this happen? Why did Abraham and his children scarcely notice at the time, and seemingly an entire community as well? The substance used by the attackers to incapacitate the victims and their families is familiar to many in Latin America. Some Mennonite farmers reportedly use it to anesthetize bulls before castration. In Manitoba, men sprayed it through bedroom windows before entering, causing dramatic effects, particularly with memory, rendering individuals unaware or powerless to defend themselves. It wasn't until their trial, which took place almost 2 years later in 2011, that the full scope of their crimes came to light. The transcripts read like a horror movie script. Victims ranged in age from 3 to 5. The youngest had a broken hymen, purportedly from finger penetration. The girls and women were married, single, residents, visitors, and even one mentally disabled child. Though it's never discussed and was not part of the legal case, residents knew that men and boys had been raped too. Many of the rape victims in Manitoba never had the chance to speak with a professional therapist, even though some expressed willingness to do so if given the opportunity. Manitoba Colony Bishop Johann Newdorf, the community's highest authority, had informed a visitor in 2009, after the perpetrators were caught, that counseling was unnecessary since the victims were unconscious during the assaults. Other victims interviewed, those who awoke momentarily during the rapes, as well as those with no memory of the night, expressed a desire to speak with a therapist about their experiences. However, they found it nearly impossible because there are no Low German-speaking sexual trauma recovery experts in Bolivia. All the women spoken to were unaware that the greater Mennonite world, particularly progressive groups in Canada and the U.S., had offered to send Low German counselors to Manitoba. This lack of awareness stemmed from the leadership's rejection of these offers, viewing them as attempts to undermine their traditional way of life. The leadership's refusal likely had other motivations as well, such as avoiding the emotional trauma of the women stirring up controversy or drawing too much attention to the community. Those under the age of 18 were brought in for psychological assessment as mandated by Bolivian law, each showing signs of post-traumatic stress disorder and being recommended for long-term counseling. However, none of these girls received any type of therapy following their evaluations. One woman, years later, disclosed how her daughter had also been raped, but the two had never discussed it, and her daughter remained unaware of her mother's own experience as a survivor. In old colonies, discussing rape brings shame upon the victim, perpetuating a culture of silence and avoidance. All the victims admitted that thoughts of rape occupied their minds almost daily. Alongside seeking support from close friends, many found solace in their faith. Helena, for example, claimed to have forgiven her perpetrators despite the emotional toll. The acceptance of such crimes remained puzzling until a conversation with Minister Juan Fair, who emphasized the importance of forgiveness within their community as a path to salvation. In other words, they must forgive the rapists in order for themselves to get into heaven. This mindset, coupled with the isolation and deeply ingrained beliefs, sheds light on why addressing such crimes within the old colony remains challenging. Manitoba's leaders encourage residents to forgive incest, too. It's a lesson that a woman named Agnes learned in a painful way. She left the Manitoba colony in 2009. She, too, woke one morning with headaches and there was dirt in her bed, but she said she had never thought much about that morning since and wasn't included in the lawsuit because she saw no reason to come forward after the perpetrators were nabbed. What she thought about much more was incest. She wasn't sure when it started, but she remembered that from a very young age, she was fondled by her older brothers. She was one of 15 children growing up in the old colony of Riva Palacios. Her family moved to neighboring Manitoba colony when she was 8. Agnes said that the abuse would happen in the barn, in the fields, or in the siblings' shared bedroom. She didn't realize it was inappropriate behavior until the age of 10, when she was given a stern beating after her father found her brother fondling her. "My mother could never find the words to tell me that I was being wronged or that it was my fault," she recalled. After that, the molestation continued, but Agnes was too scared to go to anyone for help. When she was 13 and one of her brothers tried to rape her, Agnes worriedly told her mom. She wasn't beaten this time, and for a while her mother did the best she could to keep the two apart, but the brother eventually found her alone and raped her. Sibling assaults became common for Agnes, but she had no recourse. Old colonies lack a police force, so ministers handle wrongdoing internally. However, since youth aren't considered church members until baptism, issues like these are often dealt with at home. Agnes never considered seeking help outside the colony. From birth, she was taught to distrust the outside world. Even if she wanted to reach out, communication with the non-Low German-speaking world was nearly impossible. "I just learned to live with it," Agnes said. She believed the incest stopped when she began dating boys, filing it away as a thing of the past. However, when Agnes married and had children of her own, family members began molesting her daughters during visits. It was happening to them too, she said. Her eldest daughter disclosed that their grandfather had asked her to touch him inappropriately. Although Agnes' father didn't abuse her, he allegedly mistreated her children until she fled Manitoba with them. She later caught her nephew molesting her youngest daughter. In the international Mennonite community, There's debate about the extent of incest in old colonies. Some argue it's prevalent everywhere, while others believe it's significant within old colonies. One couple established Casa Mariposa, a shelter for abused old colony women and girls, but few women seek help due to the challenges of leaving their families and the only world they've ever known, forever. The owner of the shelter insists sexual abuse rates are higher in old colonies compared to the U.S. She considers these communities a breeding ground for sexual abuse, emphasizing the need to help women recognize they've been wronged and break the cycle of acceptance. One of the youngest victims to speak with prosecutors in the Manitoba case was as young as 11 during the time of the rapes. Speaking of the prosecution, they had a challenging job. Prosecuting attorney Perez said it was very challenging to convince them to testify. The women often refused, saying, "No, we don't want to," and would start crying. I would tell them, "But if you don't cooperate, I won't have witnesses. The men will be acquitted, and then they will return to the colony." This made the women and girls cry even more. Perez told the press that the Mennonite rapists went around the houses of their neighbors in groups of two or three people, and sometimes they did so alone. He said they each raped at least three women a night. Perez said that Abrams Peters, when he was apprehended, declared that he couldn't stop doing it. It was also learned that one of the convicted men raped his two daughters. Eventually, the women overcame their discomfort, and the trial began in 2011. Gladys Alba, one of the judges in the case, vividly recalled the powerful testimonies she heard in the courtroom. They had the courage to confront the abusers and accuse them face to face. That's what impressed me. She also believes there may have been many more victims. It could be more than 200, she says, but some of these victims remained hidden due to cultural factors. They didn't attend or were not taken by their parents to the forensic examinations. It's difficult for a Mennonite woman to get married if she has sexual relations, which is why many parents preferred to remain silent and say, "Nothing happened in this house." In August 2011, seven were sentenced to 25 years in prison for rape. One was sentenced to 12 years for supplying the drug used to debilitate the victims, and one, well, he escaped, and he isn't mentioned again. Another would escape from prison several years later, and him we're going to talk about in depth, but I'll come back to him shortly. By 2022, two additional men were tried and convicted in related trials. In the sprawling Palmsacola prison complex, 7,000 Bolivian men are locked behind high concrete walls. Conjugal visits are allowed, and at least two of the Mennonite convicts found partners and started families since they were incarcerated. All the Manitoba men continued to deny they are rapists. When asked, "So why would women and girls lie?" one replied, "Simply because their parents forced them to accuse us. I think we were accused because we are poor. We couldn't defend ourselves. When they took me from Manitoba, I was a virgin. I told them that all the accusations were lies, but they locked me in a container without any evidence. They threatened me and kept me for almost a week in the neighborhood until they took me to a police cell," he says. Of course, it's not uncommon for prisoners to deny having committed a crime. But what is strange about this case is that Mennonites from different sectors of the community, the most liberal and the most conservative in Bolivia and in North America, continued to express doubts about the convictions of the Manitoba men. There are different stories. Some say the accused men were unpopular in Manitoba, and the colony paid the Bolivian judiciary to keep them in prison. Others believe that the men were scapegoated to cover up a broader culture of family sexual abuse. Many doubt the use of this powerful narcotic spray. Prosecuting attorney Perez, however, rejects these theories and dismisses claims that the men were forced to confess to rape under threat of torture. "That was his version," said the prosecutor. "But they wrote those confessions in their own language, indicating which houses they broke into and who they raped. And what they wrote coincided with the results of the forensic examinations of the victims. It was seen that those same girls and women had been raped in the houses the men identified." Given time, life in Manitoba seemed to calm on the surface. Women attended to household chores, men worked in the fields, and children returned to school without fear. However, the memory of the past traumas lingered. Families reinforced security with steel bars and perimeter grills, replacing trust with fear. While 8 men were imprisoned and 1 remained on the run, cases of rape within Mennonite communities persisted, albeit differently. Incidents occurred in open fields, prompting church leaders to take swift disciplinary action, shrouding each case in secrecy to avoid further media scrutiny. Despite these efforts, forgiveness remained a central tenet within the colony. Bernard Dick, a 50-year-old farmer, felt called by God to advocate for the release of the imprisoned men. Manitoba's leaders hired lawyers to explore legal avenues for their release, causing tension within the community and testing the faith of its members. Some grappled with the distinction between sin and crime, emphasizing forgiveness over punishment. Church leaders lobbied intensely for the men's release, citing the prison's harsh conditions as sufficient punishment. In 2016, an appeal reached Bolivia's Supreme Court of Justice, but it was denied, dashing hopes for their release. Despite this setback, Manitoba's bishops remained undeterred in their efforts for justice and reconciliation. Meanwhile, in prison, the men became hardened, and they learned how to work the system. Abrams Peter Dick, yes, that's his real name, was 19 years old when he was arrested in 2009. He was the youngest, but was also considered the most violent of the men arrested. According to The Opinion, a Bolivian news website, Abrams received a visit from a man who was a director of a drug addiction center. He asked Abrams some questions to determine whether he used drugs. He didn't, but he lied. This man knew this, but he arranged for Abrams to be evaluated by a psychiatrist. After a week, this man, accompanied by the psychiatrist, returned to the prison for Abrams' evaluation, and once that was completed, it was taken to a judge. The man wasn't doing this because he cared for Abram. What he was really after was money. If Abram's family paid him, he would get Abram released to a rehab center. While there, Abram would be under house arrest, but it would be better than jail. Abram's family happily paid, and it wasn't the first time they had tried to pay for his freedom. His family had paid 25,000 bolivianos to get out of jail. This is equivalent to about $3,700. Early on, the men he paid took his money and ran. Abram was sentenced right alongside the rest of the men, but 8 years later, he would try again. His relatives, his brother, and his uncle gave money to this new man on at least 3 occasions. The first time, they gave him $2,000, and this was followed by 2 additional payments, some of which would go to a judge, a lawyer, and other judicial authorities. He was released to the treatment center on the premise that he suffered from drug dependence and therefore needed rehabilitation. At the end of October 2019, Abrams arrived with a police officer at the drug center. He was handed over to the director, and it was assumed he would begin treatment for at least 6 months. However, the convicted man left the place after only 4 months. Let me clarify that he was released to the public. He was free after serving only 8 years of his sentence. When Abrams Peters Dick returned to the colony of Manitoba, he reintegrated into it. He attended the 3-hour preaching and prayer meetings at the church every Sunday and devoted part of his time to farm work. Very few people recognized him. He was now a man of 6 feet tall with an athletic body and seasoned in the hard life of a very violent person. But he was free to do as he pleased. No one came after him for years. Not until he was linked to a serial killer. Very far from the Mennonite colonies, in January of 2022, the cybercrime police force tracked an alleged sexual offender to his home in a popular area of the city of El Alto. Richard Schoke, a robust man with short hair, was detained without resisting. From his social networks, he offered work to young women before savagely harassing several of them. He would torture them, and he murdered 2 minors. Those that survived his attacks would report their cases. The police detected a pattern of behavior, and tracking him on the internet was simple. The police discovered on his cell phone the photographs of two young girls reported missing. During subsequent interrogations, he confessed to having murdered them. They were buried in the patio of his house. The man operated through a false profile on social networks that helped him make appointments with the young women to whom he offered money for prostitution. These dates would often happen inside the women's homes. When they did, he would arrive dressed as a police officer. He carried packages disguised as drugs, which he would pretend to find in their homes, and then he'd abuse his victims, justifying his actions because of the drugs he supposedly found. Choke was not only a rapist and a serial killer. He was a convict, previously sentenced to 30 years in prison without the right to pardon, for murdering a 20-year-old woman in 2013, but who had enjoyed unrestricted freedom since 2019. He had bribed his way out of jail, just like Abram Peters Dick had. When his case came to light and spread throughout the media, collectives of women and relatives of the victims took to the streets demanding justice. The prosecutors carried signs criticizing judicial operators. Women's groups demanded a law to toughen sentences for rapists, femicides, and infanticides. A judge, for a bottle of alcohol and a couple $1,000s, had granted house arrest to the man who pretended to be a police officer to take control of his victims. Behind Choke's case, a much broader plot of judicial corruption was discovered. There were several common factors. Rapists and murderers, all sentenced to long terms. But after being bribed, a few judges released these prisoners to hospitals or drug rehab clinics where they would simply walk out. A case review commission was formed with the participation of the highest authorities of Bolivia. The commission identified 150 cases of irregular release of convicted prisoners like Richard Choke. Abram's Peter Dick was one of these. He would be rearrested in early March of 2022, but by then, much more damage had been done. Since 2019, when he left the drug rehabilitation facility, he had moved to another Mennonite colony. Shortly after, the cases of mass rapes returned with more force, and in exactly the same way as in 2009. The attacks were reported in homes in the neighboring Mennonite colonies of Piedras, too, and Belize. "It's a stronger group than the previous one," indicated the first complaints filed in the middle of the pandemic. But again, they didn't have the support of the victims. In 2022, the first night of autumn arrived adorned with stars and a beautifully full moon. The pale clarity, accompanying the pulsating glow of fireflies, spread across the vast eastern plains of Santa Cruz. In the moonlight, eight men conversed animatedly, their discussion punctuated by the monotonous drone of cicadas and the high-pitched chirping of crickets. Individually, they converged at the foot of an old abandoned mill, situated on the outskirts of the Belize colony. As the sun set over the green fields of soybeans, beans and corn, the chorus of tropical birds that crossed the Amazonian sky daily in large flocks gradually faded away. Among the men, the youngest was 17 years old, and the oldest was 54. The latter distributed a few cigarettes, a bit of liquor, and small cylindrical containers containing a transparent fluid. This homemade concoction was a recipe from his old friend, Abram Peters Dick, made of a half-dozen veterinary drugs used as anesthetic and tranquilizers for livestock. "Take the spray and use it as you see fit," he advised. Clad in blue overalls, light-colored checkered shirts, and white wicker hats, they exchanged knowing smiles. With intense blue or green eyes, all were strong, tall, and resolute. Less than a 10-minute walk away stood a single-story house, home to a couple with 9 children. At the stroke of midnight, the group headed there. With a temperature of pleasant 20 degrees Celsius, or 68 Fahrenheit, it was an agreeable night. In the conservative Mennonite colonies, windows lacked glass, allowing fresh air to circulate, while a fine mesh prevented insects from entering. In complete silence, The group sprayed the mixture from the outside through tiny slits, particularly targeting the bedrooms where the families slept peacefully. Repeatedly squeezing the spray bottles, they dispersed the liquid into thousands of particles throughout the room. Leaning against the exterior walls, the men slid slowly down into a sitting position, waiting for at least 30 minutes until the sleeping drug induced a deep slumber in their unsuspecting targets. With experience in such clandestine operations in the colonies, the group had easily navigated the country roads, dusty and seldom traveled, that crisscrossed the countryside. Preferring candles or oil lamps to electric light, traveling in horse-drawn carts, generating their warmth through sustainable means, and prohibiting paved roads from connecting the 11 Mennonite colonies in the municipality of Pylon. They lived suspended in time, adhering to their ancient customs. But the 8 men harbored a longing for freedom. Among them were single men, married men with children, and even grandparents. They risked banishment and expulsion from the church if discovered. The group had previously discussed the consequences of their actions, but on March 21, 2022, amidst the changing season from rainy summer to warm autumn, their urgency outweighed such considerations. In eagerness, the youngest member, without a word, rose and entered through the door, which lacked an inside lock, similar to his own house. 2 others followed suit, aged 19 and 25. The rest disapproved and hurriedly left the scene. This was the 2nd time they had targeted that house in the last 6 months. Inside the home, someone who lived there heard a noise and saw shadows by their bed, prompting a desperate scream. The intruders fled, and the 17-year-old stumbled and fell while escaping. As he quickly rose to his feet, the moonlight illuminated his face and revealed his blonde hair. A young woman recognized him, having seen him at church on Sundays and as her classmate in school. Fear gripped the family, leading to tears. In this home, governed by a strict adherence to religious teachings, there was no exchange of comforting words or gestures. Instead, the severity of the father's expression fostered silent sympathy for each other's suffering. The impatience of an impetuous young man thwarted a new group sexual assault. The religious leaders knew for a long time that rapes were happening again in their communities. The rapes had moved outwards from the Manitoba colony. New women complained of the same symptoms that the women of Manitoba had years earlier. While others woke at dawn lying in open fields and badly beaten, the level of violence was on a rise. 3 women had marks of mechanical asphyxiation on their necks. Their attackers had spared their lives. Nearly a month earlier, police had rearrested Peter Abrams. 20 days after his arrest, news of the new violations in Belize and Piedras II had reached the media. 8 men were arrested, and prosecutor Camilo Velasquez has no doubt that Abram Peter's Dick was a kind of mentor for this new group that, unlike the previous one, had excessively aggressive behavior towards its victims. If they remained free, the death of some woman was certain, Velasquez warned. 2 Mennonites specifically named Abram in their statements. At that moment, there should have been 16 confessed rapists, some sentenced and others in preventive detention in the Santa Cruz prisons. According to later statements, 4 of the first Mennonite convicts, including the one sentenced to 12 years, had gained their freedom with payments to these judges. The money came from donations from international Mennonite colonies, mostly from the United States, Canada, and Mexico. As of the most recent source I could find, which was in 2022, Bolivian authorities are continuing to investigate and search for the men who had been released. At that same time, in 2 other neighborhoods, said prosecutor Camilo Velasquez, there are rumors of new mass rapes, but without formal complaints to Bolivian authorities. These rapes are continuing to happen. In the face of mounting violence and injustice, the resilience of victims and the dedication of law enforcement stand as beacons of hope. Let us stand together, united in our commitment to safeguarding the rights and dignity of these individuals, and let our collective voices be heard. Violence against women will not be tolerated, and those responsible will be held accountable, no matter where they hide. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Twisted Travel and True Crime. I really appreciate it. If you have a minute, I would love for you to give us a good rating and review. I would also really appreciate it if you would check out our social media. There are links to both of those things in the show description, the episode description, rather. I do have a couple of recent ratings and reviews to share with you. The first is from AuburnFan41, who says, "I love Sandy Allen's style. She has a very calming voice, but every once in a while she gets a little animated, and I love it. She can be sassy. Her stories are very interesting and not very long. Sometimes that's all my attention span can handle. Keep up the good work." Thank you. The next one is 2 stars from Too Many Pets. It says, "The content is very good and Sandy has a nice voice for podcasting, but I can't listen anymore. Not only does she sound like she's reading a script, but she constantly stumbles over her words. I guess it's too much trouble to try re-recording, but by not doing so, she's putting out a sloppy, unprofessional product." I have to admit that I am not a professional. It's just me. I don't really know what I'm doing, but I'm learning as I go. So I'll take the advice and try to improve on that. The next one is from Millie Moopop's mommy from Great Britain. It says, "My new favorite. I've recently discovered this podcast and I'm so glad I did. The cases are really interesting and varied, and Sandy has such a soothing voice. I can't wait to listen to every episode." Thank you, Millie Moopop's mummy. Finally, the last one for this episode, Concerned Citizen Australia, says, "Up there with the best of true crime podcasts. I would liken this podcast as a mixture between Case File and Swindled, two of my all-time favorites. I had run out of good podcasts and stumbled across this one when half asleep. So glad I did. Easy listening and entertaining." I'm not going to lie, that is high praise for me because I love both of those shows. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And to all of you still listening, I wish you all fair winds, following seas, and safe travels of all kinds.